Africa has some of the best renewable energy resources in the world. Less than 8% of its hydropower has been tapped. In Malawi, fewer than 1 in 7 people are connected to the grid. The demand for power is not a forecast, it's already there. And yet, capital is slow to follow. The problem is perception. Africa reads as high risk, but does the risk coverage investors demand always reflect the risk that's actually on the table? Michael Cupid develops projects in sub-Saharan Africa. He spent years working inside the gap between how these markets look from the outside and how they actually operate on the ground. Before we move on, a lot of people listening will have follow-up questions after an episode like this. What does storage growth actually look like in your markets? And these are exactly the questions Co, Modo Energy's AI analyst, is built for. Try it out now, link in the description. Back to the episode. I'm your host, Ed Porter. Welcome back to Transmission. Hello, Michael, and welcome to Transmission.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And let's get straight into this, right? So this episode is going to be all about energy projects in Africa. What is the one thing that people always get wrong about energy projects in Africa?
I think there are two things as far as I can see, right? I think the first is probably how difficult a place it is to actually do business. And if you're, you know, fresh off the boat kind of thing, it's a bit daunting. But actually, when you get kind of stuck in, you roll up your sleeves, then it's pretty much the same as doing business here. People are, you know, open for meetings, you know, and, you know, they'll generally work with you to do something that's constructive that helps their country. So, you know, it's not a difficult place to do business. There's no more red tape there than there is here. You've just got to know what it is, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the first part. I think the second bit is probably also just returns. I think everybody probably has a view of it being a place of, you know, we make bountiful, you know, returns on capital that's invested. And actually, you can make a little bit more than you can make here. And that's a challenge, which perhaps we'll come on to later, just around the financing. Mm-hmm. You know, typically, you know, mid to high teen returns is all that we can get. Certainly nothing starting with a 2, unless we're willing to take an awful lot of risk, which again comes back to being challenging for the financing. So I think for me, you know, the biggest misconceptions are probably those two things, which is good and bad.
Yeah, it seems like a real surprise, right, to be like looking at mid-teens IRRs. But I think that's a lot of like my bias, that I see a lot of projects in Germany, GB, US, Australia, that seem to be, if I had 100 people that work in battery projects that I know, I probably say like 95 of them are in those markets. And then the emerging markets is only a real handful.
Yeah. No, look, I'd agree. I think the difference though is just the balance of risk in those contracts. So GB, Germany, US, you know, they are partly contracted, partly merchant. So, you know, you'd expect, you know, to get beyond utility returns for those markets. Mm. Our projects in Africa are all contracted, right? So we're on 20-year capacity payment type structures. So there's still risk because you've got a counterparty risk and they've generally not got a credit rating, but you can put structures around that to make sure that it works. So kind of mid to high teens, you know, on a reasonably contracted basis, often with kind of multilateral bank, I'll explain that in a minute, kind of guarantees that sit behind it help you. So places like the World Bank and other institutions will put a wrap around it. They'll put a risk guarantee around it, which will cover most of the key risks. Mm. It costs you money, quite a bit of it, but ultimately it kind of, it takes that risk out of the project. So, particularly places like MIGA, so that's the Multilateral Insurance and Guarantees Agency, which is part of the World Bank, provide kind of some guarantees to the, on a company by company basis. And they'll cover contract risk, change of contract, price risk, FX, foreign exchange convertibility, all sorts of things. But that generally costs you about 1.5% of annual revenue to kind of insure against. So it's not an inconsequential
amount.
It's not a
5 or 10% difference.
But it's not huge.
Yeah. Really interesting. Let's come back onto that slightly later on. I think first our listeners might be thinking, okay, I'm putting on my sort of African battery storage journey hat and I'm trying to work out like where is Africa in this journey? What's really driving the journey towards looking at battery projects in Africa? Why is it changing? How far along is it?
I think in Africa, what you've got is you know, an abundance of renewable energy, right? So only about 8% of hydropower, for example, in the continent is actually tapped. next to no solar and no wind has been built. So you've got this kind of massive resource amongst some of the best in the world. And then you've got very unstable grids to kind of back it up. Then you've got a ton of demand growth. In Malawi, where we work, there's only 14% of the population are actually connected to the network.
Wow.
So you've got this huge kind of demand growth. And then you've got the process of industrialization and. So, you know, there is a lot of potential there, but it is very slow. On the flip side, you know, we're in a situation where, you know, fossil fuels aren't exactly coming back into favor, but a lot of African countries are sitting on huge coal reserves, gas reserves, oil reserves. And they're kind of saying, well, you know, everybody in Europe, North America and so on, industrialized and drove their economies burning fossil fuels. So why can't we do the same? So we've got to win an argument around the fact that renewables and batteries and other means of storage and system stabilization offer a lower cost route to that industrialization process than simply extracting and burning fossil fuels.
I think that's really interesting because there used to be this kind of the logic that for some countries, and I'll use GB or Germany as an example, that they're a little bit trapped because they have this massive transmission network that they need to sort of provide upkeep to that was on coal, still is in some cases, moving to gas and is going to sort of transition in a stage-by-stage process towards a more renewable-dominated grid. Sometimes people would say, if you haven't already got that grid in place, perhaps slightly more fortunate because you can design a system that is built from a renewables first perspective. And so instead of running 2 gigs to this particular part of the coast that has good water access, actually, instead of running that 2 gig line, you could run that line in 5 different places to 5 different solar parks. And actually, you could build a system from the ground up with renewables that might be cheaper and effectively skip a step. Is that argument still in vogue, or is that sort of?
No, I mean, look, it's on the money. You're absolutely right. You know, I mean, our grid in the UK, as everybody I'm sure knows, was built around, you know, the coal fields, right? And how you transport power from Yorkshire, Nottinghamshire to the demand centres. And it's very different in most of sub-Saharan Africa. And I'll give a caveat to that in a minute. But in most sub-Saharan African countries, the grids tend to be quite spindly and need a lot of work. You know, and if you take Lake Turkana Wind Farm, which is, I think, still the biggest wind farm in sub-Saharan Africa at 320 megawatts. You know, there's a 254-kilometer transmission line to connect it to the grid. Wow. And from that now, we're starting to kind of sprite other, you know, T's from it. Yep. So the grid is being built more around sources of generation, which are by their nature renewable rather than fossil fuels. The exception to that is in South Africa, which has got much more of a UK type model where the grid was built around big coal-fired power stations and a nuclear power station down in Cape Town. And now, as you're plugging more and more renewables in, getting more and more network constraints and just kind of loading constraints, they just can't physically get enough power down the existing lines. Yeah. And that, you know, we can perhaps come on to that because it's quite interesting in terms of use cases for batteries. That's a very different model from perhaps you see in Europe more broadly, because it's how do you deal with those network constraints is kind of prime driver.
Let's then talk a little bit more about South Africa, because we've kind of gone towards it. I think Eskom, the grid operator there, if you're sort of familiar with that grid, outages aren't uncommon. In fact, many people will have like sort of a generator at home, which will kind of be just in case the grid goes down, they'll have a way of kind of bringing their lights back on at home. Is that more commonplace in grids? And is that feels like a really good solution for, rather than having diesel gensets in all these homes, like more batteries, more solar, will get you through these days, right?
Yeah. No, that's right. So, I mean, you know, it's not just South Africa. It's kind of right across the continent. There's a lot of kind of, you know, microgrid, mini grid, rooftop type solutions. And there's quite a lot of providers of those kind of solutions on quite clever financing mechanisms to allow households to connect. In South Africa, you know, 5 years ago, you had a lot of what's called load shedding. So, you know, you'd have households who were generally off the grid for disconnected for kind of 4 hours at a time on a scheduled basis. And a lot of South Africans got fed up with that and started to put rooftop solar in with batteries to kind of help carry them through that 4 hour period. So, you know, South Africa is quite interesting because the load shape is turning more into kind of that duck kind of form, where in the middle of the day, you know, you need less from the grid. But again, coming back to their transmission system, they've got long, long lines running thousands of kilometers, which aren't suited to connecting lots and lots of renewables. So in the battery case, the first tender round that they ran through the IPP office there was all the batteries were actually on one transmission line from the Northern Cape, which is kind of Namibia, western side of South Africa. And it runs across to Gauteng, which is where Johannesburg and Pretoria is. And that's a very congested line because that's the main demand center. Mm-hmm. So you had a transmission line that didn't have enough capacity in it and a load of renewables projects that were thumping out mainly solar, so during the daytime, and couldn't transmit to where the demand centers were. So at five substations along what is about a 1,000 kilometer transmission line, they put 100 megawatt 4-hour batteries to basically just fill them up as demand picks up, as the sun picks up, and then they release them back into the system in the evening to keep Gauteng going. So there's quite a lot of that careful planning that's going on to optimize the existing infrastructure and use batteries probably actually in a quite a different way. I know we see it a little bit between Scotland and England, but a lot of it more like that.
Yeah, and definitely we don't see it enough, right? We almost in GB we don't allow the network companies to own battery storage, and there's some good reasons behind that. But it's interesting to see people sort of actively trying to use storage to get the most out of transmission.
Yeah.
It's something that we seem to have a little bit forgotten in GB.
Yeah.
But this episode's all about Africa, so let's not get into too much GB detail. Let's actually move towards projects that you're really delivering right now. So you've got projects in Malawi and Kenya.
Yes.
How did you end up sort of picking Malawi and Kenya? And then let's talk through sort of how do these projects actually work? How do they make revenue?
Sure. No, that's fine. So how do we pick those two countries? So, before we set up our business Energy Storage Africa, we were working in the UK actually, and we got involved in some of the first flush of battery projects in the UK. And so we could see it was a technology that was kind of coming to the fore, and we could see a real case for using it in Africa. We wanted to try and pick a couple of countries where if you could make it work in those two countries, you could make it work anywhere. So Malawi on one extreme is a tough place to work, not because it's, crime-ridden or anything else. It's probably one of the safest places we work. But in terms of kind of the network, the capacity and the people that you have to work with there, it's kind of on the one extreme. And Kenya is at the other. It's a largely unbundled electricity system, almost European in its kind of look and feel, and is a much bigger system. So we want to try and pick two examples almost where we could demonstrate that it works and then try and spread the love and the knowledge out around the continent.
And just if it's someone's first time sort of hearing unbundled, like what does that actually mean in terms of like how the system works?
Yeah, so I guess we take it for granted in the UK and Europe, but effectively in Kenya, the generating company and the transmission company are separated from the distribution business, and the distribution business still does all the customer billing.
Okay.
And that business also effectively is our counterpart for the contracts that we have as part of our business. That's kind of at its simplest form. So we have to have a transmission agreement with the transmission company, and then we have to have our kind of capacity contract with a single buyer. And I can explain a bit more about market model if that's helpful.
Let's definitely go there, right? So how do you get money? Would these assets be intending to sort of trade every day on a wholesale market, or is it much more like you provide that capacity to the distribution operator and they pay you on a 15-year contract?
Yeah, so the way that we work generally is we contract to the state utility, and the state utility in most countries buys from IPPs, transmits the electricity and sells it to customers, right? So we have to contract with the entity that is responsible for buying power from generators, whether that's stuff that they own or stuff that IPPs come along and provide, to them. Private sector providers want to sell to them. So we enter into a contract with what's called a single buyer, and they operate in most of these markets, and they aggregate all of the generation to supply to their customers as a basic rule. So our contracts tend to be up to 20 years and they're just on a straight capacity and an availability charge. And then sometimes we have to add in an activation charge. So not too dissimilar to the way that batteries are used in, you know, frequency response services for ancillary services markets in the UK and Europe.
But in some ways, like, very different, right? So the use case is similar, but the contracting is so different, right?
Yeah.
So in Europe or US, we're all looking at like hyper-optimized markets where the system operator can pick whichever price it wants from whichever battery it wants. And that means there's huge amounts of competition, which drives down the sort of price that people receive because it's like, as I said, super competitive. We've kind of moved away from these longer dated contracts where you can kind of lock in. I think that will shock people that they, in a way, if you could get comfortable with the areas and the counterparties that you're dealing with, as you were mentioning at the start, actually the structure of the contract with a 15-year tenor is almost more financeable. There's a lot of caveats in that, right?
Yes.
There are a lot of caveats in that. I don't want to get misquoted, but it's almost more comfortable, right? In that structure.
I think you know, the fact that we can enter into a, you know, as you say, 15 years in South Africa, up to 20 years in other locations, against a known utility who has some kind of payment track record as well to independent power producers, to IPPs, you know, is a great structure. And it's very different from the UK and other markets, because obviously here, as you say, hyper-optimized, focus very much on the revenue stack, day ahead, hour ahead, as to what they can actually make, right? Whereas, you know, that's the responsibility almost of our single buyer and the system operators. So they're then trying to sweat our asset, for want of a better word, as much as possible for their own gain. So we effectively lock in a return that makes our shareholders happy. And then we work with those system operators to optimize the asset to do something each day that they value. And that generally in Africa, for example, if you just look at it on one simple use case. So if in the case of Malawi, we store a load of power from hydro, run of river hydro plant overnight. And that's cheap. It's 3, 4, 5 cents a kilowatt hour, US cents a kilowatt hour. And then we store it and we use it in the morning and in the evening peaks, for example. And that enables the system operator not to dispatch high-speed diesels, which are costing 52 cents a kilowatt hour, including the fuel in the case of Malawi. So, you know, it enables them to pull down their system cost and actually reduce the cost to customer, which is regulated as well, right? Yeah. So, you know, there are these kind of different ways of looking at the revenue stack. The revenue stack is identical to what you would see in UK, Europe, but the way that it materializes is actually through cost savings to the utility, not through a direct payment to you.
And that spread between a few cents for run of river overnight to offsetting diesel generators is an incredibly attractive spread. It's probably, I'd say, like 3 times maybe what you might see in a European market. Now, obviously, you're not getting all of that, right? So it's all running through a utility, and they then have to work out like how to dispatch it, and they don't pass all of that to you. But just checking the maths of it, right? That definitely works.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it definitely works. But I think what you've got to recognize as well is those utilities are also taking risk, right? So they're taking risk on the dispatch side. So, you know, as far as we're concerned, you know, we need to earn a return which our shareholders are comfortable with. And at the same time, they're taking risks, so they need some upside to this as well, right? We're not there just to kind of extract rent, as it were, and make lots of money and then, you know, just sit back and watch. So, you know, there is a balance of risk because, you know, obviously here you're taking the risk of the revenue stack. In that case, we're not taking that revenue stack risk, you know, and so on. But what's also interesting, particularly in the Southern African power pool, which covers about 9 countries in kind of bottom half of Africa, you know, you have now got a kind of emerging kind of day ahead, month ahead merchant market.
Okay.
So, you know, one of the sites we may well look at, how do we trade more of our asset into that, because you still have these huge price swings between off-peak and peak times. So there's quite a lot that can be done. And kind of that peak price clearing at the moment, as far as we can see, is basically a diesel genset. So, you know, if we can do it cheaper than that, then we should be able to make money on a merchant basis. Finding somebody to finance that is a different kettle of fish.
Well, I think let's come on to the financing in just 1 second, but we've mentioned kind of 4 techs so far. We've mentioned solar, we mentioned coal, run of river, hydro, and then also diesel gensets.
Yeah.
And I just want to give there'll be people listening to this who've kind of got like an engineering mindset, who just want to like, who just want to make sure the cogs are in the right place. So like, sure. what does the mix look like typically in a grid like Malawi or Kenya?
Okay, so they're two completely different grids, okay. Right, as well, which is quite interesting. So there's no kind of norm, right? You're right. If you look around Europe, there's kind of a norm, yeah? You've got a bunch of baseload power.
Excluding the French.
But, you know you've got a bunch of baseload power that comes from three or four main sources. And in Africa, it's, you know, ignoring South Africa again, because it's very coal reliant still, you know, generally it's quite different. So in Malawi, I think the grid is only 550 megawatts of capacity in total. So it's very small. About 420 megawatts of that comes from run of river hydro, and it all comes from one river, which is fed from Lake Malawi, which is, I think, the seventh largest lake in the world. So it's a pretty big storage pond for those run of river. Those run of river hydros. And then the balance comes from solar. So that then breeds inherent, you know, instability. And it's got to the point where I don't think they can add much more solar onto the system because of the frequency and voltage issues that they suffer from without having more batteries. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's kind of one. Now, Kenya is completely different, right? So again, you have a river, the Tana River, which has a lot of hydro on it, and quite a lot. And then there's one hydro plant in the north, which is more of a load follower. It's more of the kind of peaking plant. You then have a load of geothermal, which is not a normal.
No, not at
not
all.
Not a normal generating kit. Obviously, Kenya sits on the Rift Valley. And, you know, you get pretty high geothermal temperatures fairly close to the surface, just around the Rift Valley. So places like Suswa and Olkaria. So they've got about, from memory, it's about 500 megawatts of geothermal, and they're building more. They've got a load of hydro, this huge wind farm. They've got another wind farm called Kepeso, which is 100 megawatts. And then about 300-400 megawatts of solar dotted around the country. And again, that's a country which is really on the move in terms of economic growth. And, you know, they've got to add 10 gigawatts plus in the next 10 years of kind of generating capacity, and with that has to come a load of batteries. And the president himself has actually recognised that and made kind of statements around it.
And 10 gigawatts as a percentage, is that?
Oh, that's a doubling, more than a doubling. So the current capacity is about 3 gigawatts. So they've got to kind of add a very substantial amount in. You've got kind of Microsoft and all of the other businesses swirling around looking for data centres. A lot of kind of Google and AI programming actually goes on in Nairobi. So, you know, you've got quite a lot on the move. You've got big industrial processes trying to start, you know, and so on and so on. And then also similarly in Malawi, it bizarrely sits on some of the world's best rare earth deposits.
Okay.
So you've got a load of kind of listed mining companies, Rio Tinto, various others, who are looking at how do they kind of work with the deposits that they've got, things like niobium, graphite, and just rare earth sands projects that they need to bring forwards. And Malawi's landlocked. You can't export the soil. You've got to process it. And suddenly, you know, 50, 100 megawatts is, you know, 200 megawatts is needed just to satisfy two or three mines. So you've got this kind of huge push towards electrification. And the only way you can do it quickly and I would argue more cheaply than fossil fuels is by deploying renewables with some batteries.
And is that looking sort of typically on grid for, yes, okay.
Yeah, the miners want, they have to have 24/7 supply. Mm-hmm. So they want certainty. And with that then means that, you know, you need to have quite a lot of reserve and backup, which most African countries don't have big reserve margins that we carry here.
It's really interesting. You kind of, you're absolutely right. It's a very different grid. But by the same token, like loads of the themes that are coming up in other markets are also coming up in these. So like if you take Texas, for example, a load of the demand comes from West Texas, which is partly driven by oil and gas load. So similar story to sort of the rare earth piece. And then grids running on run of river hydro. Well, you know, Norway would be an obvious one. And so your comment around Malawi and the amount of solar it's got and the lack of voltage control is a story that we're seeing in Spain right now. And so it's really funny that although they are totally different locations and the grids have kind of got to different places through their history, the themes that are coming up are actually quite sort of similar.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think also the other part that you've just got to remember with Sub-Saharan Africa is just distance. You know, transmission lines, you know, so there's one in Malawi which runs from kind of the central region up towards the north. which is probably 350 kilometres long. It's got no generation on it. It's just got a lot of demand at the other end. Mm-hmm. So you have huge problems with voltage loss and voltage drop from one end to the other. So, you know, you have to think quite creatively about how you kind of provide support to that mm-hmm. and continue to give good quality service to the northern half of Malawi, which is also where some of the mines are located. So you've got to do a lot of work around that. And you're also seeing quite a lot of investment using, you know, donor money. So that's coming from places like the UK government through British International Investments or whoever, or directly from places like the World Bank as grant money. But then you're also seeing kind of public-private partnerships around the transmission line. So effectively building a transmission line on a tolling agreement. So, you know, you get paid per electron that goes through the system. And, you know, that all kind of then helps to kind of finance that spread and that growth. And particularly though, also in Southern Africa, you're seeing a bigger degree of interconnection as well. So a lot of the countries are, you know, quite well interconnected. Almost to the kind of volumes and capacities of Europe. There are some bottlenecks in there, but, you know, they're fairly easy to fix because the bottlenecks aren't line capacity. Mm. It's actually a transformer capacity. So it's switching out, you know, 100 MVA for a 400 MVA transformer, which is a big job and is expensive, but it's not as expensive as having to put up a brand new 400 kV line.
Yeah. I think we've started to touch on the finance side. Let's get into that a little bit more. So we talked a little bit about the major parties putting money into these projects. And earlier we also talked about, for these projects, if you wanted to bundle up the risk element of, say, dealing with a more risky counterparty, that might add something like 1.5% to 2% maybe onto projects. Is that a sort of a fair overview of what you've seen on your projects, or would you say there are other key parties involved in getting these projects to be investable?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the first things that you need to just bear in mind is kind of the development process. So, you know, it's very different from Europe, right? You have multiple parties involved at different points of that development process and different pools of capital that you can access to be able to do that. And one flips from one to the next and then bits get sold down and everything else. The secondaries market is effectively quite alive, so that you've got multiple kind of ways of kind of securing short, medium and long-term, you know, financing to get stuff done. There's a very small pool of development capital and it's tiny and it's shrinking, which worries us quite a bit. But assuming that you can raise that, the next thing you need to have is an investor who's very patient, and we're very lucky in that regard. Getting these projects from kind of soup to nuts, you know, up to the point of construction in Malawi has taken us nearly 8 years. Wow. So, you know, you've got to have people who are patient and are in for the journey and recognize that it does take some time. There's a bigger pool of equity available when you're getting closer to construction. So once you've got your kind of key agreements signed, there's a much bigger pool of kind of infrastructure fund type capital that will kind of rally around you. And then it is actually possible, because of the contracted nature of the projects, to actually finance them using kind of fairly conventional project finance. And with that comes, though, quite a lot of kind of risk wrappers, you know, around it. So there's a lot of pre-funded debt service reserve accounts, maintenance accounts, all sorts of things that we have to fund. And in the case of Malawi, where there is a shortage of kind of hard currency, we also have to pre-fund kind of dollar convertibility from local currency into hard currency. We have to pre-fund that. So there's quite a lot of risk finance wrapping that has to go around it. But then there are also combination of kind of public sector lenders, and I'll explain that a little bit more, but then commercial banks like Standard Chartered, you know, Standard Bank and others, who will then come and also join in and as a part of that process of project financing, providing you've got those kind of risk parts right. And we also touched on kind of multilateral guarantees, this meagre kind of insurance before, right? So providing that's all in place, it's, you know, you can actually start to get, you know, crowd more money in around you, which kind of works. A lot of the projects, whether it's batteries or renewables in Africa, are generally funded using development finance institutional DFI funds. And that comes from places like African Development Bank, from PIDG, which is based in London, Private Infrastructure Development Group, and then from other kind of development finance institutions. So ours is called British International Investments. It used to be called CDC Group. There's FMO in the Netherlands and so on.
There's a long list. You see, about 10 minutes ago, you almost convinced me that doing these projects in Africa was going to be, was kind of straightforward and had like the European themes, and everyone was going to be sort of finding this now. And I've just listened to the last minute of just how complex, and maybe it's not complex, but just how complex it is in terms of building up. Maybe it's very straightforward if you know the right people and the right bodies, but it feels to me like you have to have a lot of experience perhaps to be able to navigate that journey.
I think there is a bit of that. And you know, it is a fairly small universe of people that do what we do in Africa, right? Okay. So, and we generally know each other. So, you know, it is a fairly small pool of people, but it's kind of growing. And you're getting more kind of locally based development kind of starting to take off. So people got a bit of experience of doing one thing and then set up on their own and they grow a little bit, which is, you know, which is good. But I think we, you know, in terms of financing, you know, I'm fairly long in the tooth, and I remember, you know, Dash for Gas, right? So that's kind of late 90s, early 2000s. And financing then was fairly, project financing was then fairly complex. It wasn't a simple thing. And really what we're talking about here are well-known, well-trodden paths. You've just got to structure it in the right way. And if you've got a good, you know, lead arranger working with you, then it's pretty easy to structure it in the right way and fairly quickly.
Interesting.
It's getting the projects from kind of a bare patch of earth to the point where you've got contracts in place with utility transmission connection agreement in place, you know, some kind of arrangement with government on enforceability. But once you've got those, that's what's taken us the long time. The bit from there to, you know, COD, relatively quick.
Okay. Let me ask about competition then in that space, because in my less experienced sort of knowledge of Africa, I would think about Africa, I'd think about China, and I think sort of like Belt and Road Initiative and this kind of plan that Chinese infrastructure is, or China will finance a lot of infrastructure in Africa. To what extent do you see that?
So look, we see quite a lot of, in terms of our competition, there's quite a lot of people like us running around doing things. I think that's slightly on the decline, to be honest. I think a lot of people are seeking to go to markets where they think that they can do things more quickly or more easily. And you know, so that's changing a little bit. We generally don't see kind of Chinese firms coming along and doing what we're doing. We see them on the EPC side of things, and obviously providing the kit, particularly around the battery space, not too surprisingly. You know, a lot of it's coming from that route. But, you know, what's quite interesting, and I think is perhaps slight misconception, is kind of Chinese investment into infrastructure probably peaked about 5 or 6 years ago and has really declined over the last 4 or 5 years and has become much more focused on specific things that kind of support, you know, Chinese requirements. So, you know, they're not going and building, you know, huge long railways anymore. They're not going and doing certain things. They are doing it in part, but it's very focused on almost a supply chain for manufacturing.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
You know, so that their level of spend is on I think on the decline.
Okay, well, let's go from the massive sort of geopolitical angle down to the sort of nuts and bolts piece of the technical staff on the ground. So like two totally different ends.
Sure.
How do you find getting sort of technically qualified engineers to do the work, the planners to do the work? Is that easy, or is it actually, you know, tell you what, that's much easier than we thought?
It's very difficult, right? So generally speaking, I mean, look, Malawi is probably, you know, probably the harder of the two places where we're working at the moment. You've got a good cadre of mechanical, electrical, civil engineers. You've got, you know, good accountants and lawyers and all of the professional services that you need, but they've just not done this type of thing before. Mm-hmm. And probably not done it on the scale that we're doing it on. So, you know, the first part is actually we have to spend time with those engineers, with those lawyers, with those accountants, actually just building their understanding and knowledge. And the same is true also of government, single buyer and so on. You have to spend a lot of time explaining, you know, the nuts and the bolts, actually, right down to a fairly granular level. Talent is there. It just needs a lot of coaching. I think when we look forwards from where we are now and into operations, there's a lot that has to be done around kind of optimization. You know, you talked earlier about kind of super hyper optimized plants. We're not going to get to that point, but we do need to have some kind of working algorithms and analysis that optimizes the systems as they are, where kind of flow of kind of information through, you know, SCADA and control systems isn't as good as it is here, for example. So you've got kind of imperfect information, poor gathering. And so there's quite a lot to be done on that optimization side of things. And the other part then is just the O&M bit as well. And that's hard because, you know, you can see a hub around batteries being built in South Africa because they're going to be up to about probably 2 gigawatts, probably about 4 or 5 gigawatt hours of capacity.
And so the OEMs, the EPCs, they'll have supply chain, they'll have something in the country, right?
Yeah, exactly. So they'll kind of have stuff in South Africa. South Africa to Malawi is a 2-hour flight. So it's kind of like popping up, you know, further north in the UK to go and fix something, but sort of not. So, you know, one of the things that we've got to work on and we are working on at the moment is just how do we build that kind of O&M capability, because we think we've probably got to build a bit of it ourselves. And then we've got to work with OEMs to actually, you know, be able to back a lot of this, a lot of this up. And there aren't too many O&Ms that are running around, you know, doing work. When you look in, you know, South Africa, you know, you've got 3 or 4 large Chinese suppliers of battery equipment, and they're building their kind of servicing and support hubs. And it's very difficult to see how you can then avoid using them on the basis that the support infrastructure is then around them.
Yeah. And I think, does that also mean that for those particular projects, you then look to do contract in a slightly different way in terms of having spares more locally?
Yeah. So we run, you know, on our EPC tenders, we run much longer supply and spares lists. And that also includes the substation spares lists, right? So when we're connecting, so in Malawi, we connect 132 kV. You know, we've actually got circuit breakers and other things on our spares list for the substation as well as for our plant, because obviously we can't cope with the state utility breaking down and not being able to, you know, to allow us to connect.
Fascinating. So if we're sitting here in 5 years' time, what does success look like for your projects, but also for the battery storage story in Africa?
Okay, so from our perspective, we've got 2 fairly well advanced and kind of projects that we're trying to push on. We've got 2 or 3 more in a pipeline as well. For us, kind of success means that we get to about 1.5 gigawatt hours. All of our batteries are 4-hour, they're not 1 and 2 hours. So, you know, a much smaller amount of kind of essential hourly capacity. But we want to get to about 1.5 gigawatt of gigawatt hour and a half capacity over the next few years. And we think that once we've got one working, then it'll probably be a lot easier for us to actually do more. I think when you look across Africa, you know, there is this real need to electrify and add an awful lot of capacity. And I think the last set of estimates that I saw were in the next 10 years, about 100 gigawatts of capacity needs to go in. Bigger supply chain questions on wind, solar and geothermal and all the other bits and pieces as to whether you can actually get the kit to do it and also the transmission system to do it. But, you know, conservatively, if you just simply want people to consume more electricity, you want to put localized data centers in, you want to support mining and economic growth, you've got to add an awful lot more capacity in. The only way you can do that relatively quickly is using renewables, right? So, you know, and with wind and solar comes intermittency and variability, which, you know, networks have got to manage. And I think, you know, historically, when you look across Africa, a lot of peak power has come from heavy fuel oils, so that's big marine shipping engines, not high-speed diesels, but also high-speed diesels as well. And they're all starting to come towards the end of their life. So we've got a really interesting kind of 5-year period when you can start to possibly see some of those things being replaced with you know, with batteries, which is good. But in all these cases, and I think I said this at the beginning, we've got to win the case against fossil fuels, because a lot of these countries look at it and they say, well, you did it this way, why can't we? Yeah. So you've got to win. We've got to win this argument on the basis of not just saving the planet and reducing climate, you know, reducing climate change, but we've got to win it on a largely now actually a pure commercial argument.
It makes It makes total sense, right? And you're running at, in the case of those diesels, that sort of 40 cent per kilowatt hour type piece. Like, it just seems crazy that we can't do that for less. And I really liked your example from South Africa early in terms of the batteries that are sort of staged along the transmission line. I think that type of thinking will get us a long way in terms of bringing, you mentioned spindly grids earlier, like more sort of to a higher standard of operation. So I'm going to wrap up with a final question, which is, I'm going to imagine a world where tomorrow you're in charge of the development of the power system in Africa. What's the one thing you change?
What's the one thing that I'd change? I think a lot needs to be invested into people and kind of human capacity and capability. In a lot of the places that we work, we've got really, really good people that are great to work with, and we love working with them, and they're smart and they know what they're doing. But in a lot of places, it's kind of 3, 4, 5, 6 people that you have to work with, and there's not much behind it. So that needs to be kind of expanded. So for me, the biggest thing is just continuing to invest, as a lot of the kind of international institutions have done, in kind of people capacity and capability. So that would be number one. Am I allowed some more?
Or? You're definitely allowed. You're definitely allowed some more.
I think more funding to go into things like transmission systems. And I think there's been a change in kind of model and approach to that, using kind of PPP or public-private partnership type structures. And I think people are quite interested in doing that. You can see kind of Gridworks, which is a UK-based company, Power Grid in India and so on, now trying to branch out to do kind of more of these things, and kind of creating that larger transmission system means that more people get connected, drives that economic growth and so on and so on. And I think that's really important. And I think, those for me are probably the two kind of, you know, biggest things. Plus that, and a bit more development money availability would be a nice thing.
Always nice.
But that's just a personal bugbear. But anyway.
Michael, thank you very much for coming on. It's been a fascinating conversation. I think for many of our listeners, this is probably the first time they will have heard lots of this. And so, very grateful for your time and expertise.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.